I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. He found community through the bonds of white supremacy. She lost her father and her son to a white supremacist. Christian Piccolini left the hate movement he helped form to build a counter-extremism media firm. Mindy Corporan started a foundation to assist with healing after tragedy. Today, find out how these two people are coming together to make a ripple and change the world. Then, we'll talk with a former NASA astronaut who lived for 7 months off this planet, 250 miles above Earth. He did a lot of photography, a lot up there. And we'll learn how you can share his space experience. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It seems like a true and simple fact. Nobody starts out life filled with hate, but somehow, some way, racism or anti-Semitism or homophobia works its way in and takes over, and for some portion of the population, a change happens that can turn a sweet kid into someone angry at the world and their fellow humans, frequently at groups that have endured hate for centuries. But what draws people into movements of hate, and then how do they get out of them? Those are questions being explored as part of this year's 7 Days. That's the annual series of events founded by Mindy Corporan, whose father and whose son were murdered outside the Jewish Community Center in 2014 by a man who said he was trying to kill Jews. Mindy is here with us in our studio this morning, and Mindy, welcome to KCUR.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity.
Really glad to have you. And we had hoped to be joined this morning by Christian Piccolini, who became a neo-Nazi skinhead when he was 14, but eventually left that movement and now helps others do the same. He'll be speaking as part of the 7 Days events. Due to a mix-up, though, he's unable to join us. Mindy knows his story, though, very well, and we'll talk about that some today, as well as the rest of the events of that week. Mindy, this project, of course, was born out of your family's tragedy. Remind us how the 7 Days project came to be the result you wanted to see out of that grief?
Well, they were murdered. My dad and Reet were murdered in April of 2014. And in the month of July, I was asked to attend a meeting, and it was called by several Jewish people who were friends of mine. But I think it's important to say that it was Jewish people, and they had said that the Jewish community would plan a memorial, and did I want to be part of that memorial? And after about 3 meetings, we created 7 Days, Make a Ripple, Change the World. And that's how it happened. So it started with a group of Jewish people who knew that a memorial needed to happen, and they also wanted me to be part of that.
I know that over the years since you started this, the event has grown, and you've had different kinds of events as part of it. How did it come to be that you thought about inviting Christian Piccolini, who came from this background of hate, to be part of this event? You must have had to ask yourself some hard questions.
I did. I had not intended. So at this time last year, in March, April of last year, when we were planning and wrapping up then 7 Days, I had no intentions of speaking with anyone from the white power groups or neo-Nazi groups that had not. I had actually been asked by someone locally to do an interview on the rise of hate crimes and neo-Nazism in America, and I had declined that. I had said, no, I'm not ready. And then in the month of May, literally the month of May, 3 separate people in my life, in my circle of friends, introduced me to 3 separate reformed white supremacists in different genres. So one was introduced with a book. His name, the author, is Frank Mink. And then another one was introduced as a podcast, and that is the Derek Black coming out and saying and refuting and saying that he no longer believes in white supremacy. And then the third one is the one we're talking about today, and it's Christian Piccolini. One of the gentlemen who's on my board, on the Faith Always Wins board of directors, is Irv Robinson, and he's Jewish. He's been a friend for many years, and he sent me a link to Christian Piccolini's TED Talk.
This is a TEDx Mile High talk from 2017, so not too long ago, although turns out Christian Piccolini's been telling this story for a while.
He has been telling the story for a while, and I found that as well after he and I actually spoke in July. I reached out to all three of these Reformed white supremacists. I felt like I'm very faithful, and I felt like if three separate individuals were introducing me to three separate Reformed white supremacists, God was asking me to take a step that I did not want to take. And so when you said, what questions did you ask yourself? I didn't just ask myself. I asked God, why this? Why me? Why I don't want to do this. But I did it. So I clicked on that TED Talk. And again, I reached out to all three. And Christian was very quick to respond. And in fact, he's right now been the only one of the three that has responded to me personally. And so...
Yeah, well, I mean, tell us, let's recap for listeners who maybe haven't seen that TED Talk or read his book, a little of that story. I mean, he became involved at a very young age in the neo-Nazi skinhead movement in America. How did it start for him?
Mm-hmm. So Christian was 14 years old, and his parents were immigrants themselves, which is an interesting concept. So they were Italian immigrants, and he was caught between two different worlds. He was caught with his grandparents, who were Italian immigrants, and lived in one area of Chicago, Blue Island, and then his parents worked to live the American dream. And because he was being passed back and forth between them, he was very lonely, and he wasn't finding a very good friend group. So at the age of 14, he was in an alleyway with a friend of his smoking a joint. This is how he opens mm-hmm. and talks. He's smoking a joint, and this really cool muscle car shows up, and he's totally interested in this muscle car and the guy that gets out of the car. But this gentleman slaps him on the head, knocks the joint out of his mouth, and says, "That's what the Jews and commies want you to do." And he admits, he says, "I didn't know what a Jew was, and I didn't know what a commie was." And he said, "But I was really ramped up by the power that this guy was showing me, and he felt powerless, and he was looking for how to have that same power."
So he gets involved in this movement, and it escalates. And by the time he's in his late teens, he describes himself as actually sort of helping build the movement in America.
I believe within 2 years he was helping build the movement. At the age of 16, it's really frightening to read as a parent how involved and how deep he was in it. So what happened is the gentleman who was running the show, so to speak, and recruiting Christian and other young, vulnerable teens, he got sent to prison for his actions in the movement. And Christian was then asked to take over. And he did have leadership skills, and he loved the power. He loved belonging. He was lonely, and he could direct these people, and he talks very much about that in his book, White American Youth.
Well, you mentioned belonging, and that starts to get to this question of why and how. How is it that ordinary kids, even nice kids, good kids, find themselves drawn into this? And he talks over and over, Christian does, about identity and about community and about purpose, and actually finding those things in, of all places, the neo-Nazi movement.
Correct. He was not finding that from his parents or his grandparents, and he...
Or his church or his school or his friends.
Right, right. He, at the age of 14, just felt very vulnerable, and I've heard him say, and he said to me again when I met him in March, just early March, March 4th of this year, he said, if a baseball coach had come up to me and said, "Hey, I want you on my team," he said, "I would have gone to play baseball." He said, "But that's not who showed up, and that's, I was in the alley smoking a joint, and I went the wrong way."
As you have spent a lot of time thinking about societal, how to bring about change in society, what does that make you feel, Mindy, when you hear that? I mean, do you see that as plausible? Does that match the experience you've seen out there in the world?
Well, here's what's interesting, and let me answer the question of why did I reach out to him after the TED Talk. So the shooter that murdered my dad and my son was filled with hate, and he had been raised with hate. And he talked about that. He talked very much about being raised with hate. And that was the only time that I have immersed myself in understanding someone, why they would go to such lengths to murder. And so I thought, and I stated in interviews, I stated, you know, publicly, I wrote messaging about people are raised with hate. People are raised with hate. And then Christian, I see this TED Talk, and he says, my parents and my grandparents did not raise me with hate. And so now circling back to your question, do I think it's real? Do I think it's plausible? It absolutely is, because not only is Christian coming in town to speak for 7 days, but we're also bringing in a woman that he works with named Shannon Martinez, also not raised with hate by her parents, but she had a violent act happen to her at the age of 15. She felt lonely. She felt ashamed. And only being able to connect with people that were in that white power hate group. And that's where she connected. That's how she met Christian.
You, in starting the 7 Days Project, this idea, you mentioned the ripple idea, the idea that maybe a stone in a pond of water makes a small ripple that expands outward and has a big impact. As the 7 Days event has unfolded and grown over the past few years, what impact are you seeing as it ripples out?
We reach many high school students, and that's been most of our focus. Not that we ignore adults. It's been fascinating to find adults who want to learn about other faiths, who do want to engage and learn about kindness, and I'm very thankful for that. But I want to focus on the impact that we're seeing in the high school students. This year, we sent out applications for students to join our Kindness Youth Leadership Team and our Interfaith Youth Leadership Team. They're very separate teams. And we received, between the two of them, over 100 applications. Students are looking for somewhere to belong that is nice, that mm-hmm. is good, that makes them feel good, that gives them an opportunity to grow and to lead. And so I'm seeing an impact in our students. I'm seeing an impact in the songwriting competition winners, the essay competition winners that we have, and we have a button art competition. So these students from all over the metropolitan area want to make a difference, and they want people to notice them. They want someone to say, I see you. I see that you have talent, and I appreciate you. And that's so much what I try to do and what our foundation focuses on.
You know, the story of Christian does not end with his merely coming out of the movement of white supremacy, although he does actually find his way out. How did that happen?
He found his way out because he needed some money. It's very interesting in some of the stories I've read about other white supremacists, they tend to not have access to a lot of funds. There's not a lot of people funding them. But so he needed money.
And it's hard to get a job. And he talked about being covered with tattoos.
And he is still covered with tattoos. So people will see that in Kansas City. So what he did was he was a singer. He was in a band. Actually, the foreword in the book is written by Joan Jett because he toured with Joan Jett. And so it's a really interesting conversation with him about how he met her and that happened. So he opened a record store. He opened a music store. But his goal was, he thought, to sell white power music and to bring in white power music and get revenue. But guess what? The people who gave him revenue were African-Americans.
Because he also sold punk rock and heavy metal music as well.
He had to sell a little bit of every genre. And he started meeting other people. And he said, they were nice to me. He said, I met people who were gay, and they were nice to me. I met people who were black, and they were nice to me. I met people who were Jewish, and they were nice to me. And they gave him kindness. They offered him love, even though he had white power signs up in his store. And he said the act of love should never be dismissed. Hmm. That's what changed him.
Eventually, he not only changed his mind, but he started taking other steps. He went to school. He got a degree in international relations. He launched a media firm, a consulting firm that basically works to help other people also get out.
Yes. So he has a documentary. We're going to show about 9 minutes of that documentary, Breaking Hate. And what he focuses on now is helping people get out of hate. And he even has gone so far as to introduce a young man who was white power, neo-Nazi, covered with tattoos to, I'm going to forget her name, but it's the mother of the young woman that was murdered in Charlottesville.
Uh-huh. So yes. during the white nationalist protests. There.
So very recently, he's made an introduction of this young man who is filled with hate and this mom who lost her daughter. So it's a very similar connection between me and Christian that, you know, the very first time we connected on email, he said, how can I help you? And I said, I don't know. I'm not sure that I want you to help me. I don't know yet. And but he's very open to helping people with whatever path they need.
It's such an interesting story for me, Mindy, of redemption and forgiveness as well. I mean, one of the things that he shares in that same TED Talk is that some of the music he wrote 25 years ago was listened to by the man who walked into a church in Charleston, South Carolina, and shot 9 people during a Bible study. He said that that music was part of what inspired him. You know, Christian Piccolini's been doing this work for 20 years since then, on the good side, but the actions still have implications. How do you look at that and thinking about what has happened in your life far more recently, and be okay with looking forward?
You know what I'm okay with is, I have to tell you, when I talked to him on July 5th on the phone for the first time, I wasn't sure if I was going to be okay. So I want to be clear about that. I was not sure what path I was going to take or where this was going to take us. And the more I've spoken to him live on the phone and reviewed everything that he's been doing, I see that he is making such a big effort to do that. He needs people like me to come beside him and say, I believe in you. And when we talked the first time, he said to me, Mindy, your story completes my story because you are a victim. And he said, and nothing I do matters if a victim doesn't say it's okay and I forgive you. So when the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting happened, he and I had been really forming our relationship and confirming that he was going to come and speak with Shannon Martinez. He was the first person who reached out to me after the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting. And he said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry this keeps happening. I know that, you know, together, those of us who are working on this effort, we will make the world a better place.
One way you're trying to make the world a better place is through this event. What exactly will Christian Piccolini and Shannon Melendez be doing when they come here?
Thank you. They're arriving on in enough time on the 11th of April to speak to the Blue Valley School District. And so I want to be clear about that. It's an opportunity for students to attend, but it's not mandatory. And the superintendent of schools, Todd White, has been very helpful, and a student advisory board has been helpful in planning this event. So it's been very student-led when we took the conversation to them. So they won't just be speaking. I'm going to be interviewing them. I feel like my perspective and then some of the students' questions, their perspective, that's what we want to hear. We just don't want someone talking at us and not getting a chance to interact. So there'll be an interview process on the 11th in the afternoon that is not open to the public. But right now we're testing what does it look like to bring that many people together in a school district. And then the evening of the 11th is open to the public. It's at Church of the Resurrection. It's located in the new foundry of the Church of the Resurrection. And again, it'll be similar format. Again, it'll probably now be geared more to adults rather than students. We'll be talking to the adults and whoever's there, but mostly to the parents. I mean, I've read his book twice, and I am appalled at what he did as a teenager. And so I want people to see that can happen and that parents need to be aware. And then on Friday, April 12th, this is the first time that the Faith Always Wins Foundation in 7 days has had a fundraiser during our week. Almost everything we do is free of charge, but it's a business luncheon, and it's hosted by Holy Grace and Trinity Cathedral downtown. And right now, we've got over 120 people registered for that luncheon, and I'm very excited about the opportunity that people will want to come and hear a little bit more from Christian and Shannon stories.
And her name is Shannon Martinez. I misspoke a moment ago when I gave her name.
Thank you.
In the years since Christian got out and since he's been doing this work, one of the things he talks about is individual lives that have been changed sort of one by one, a person he meets who finds their way out of the movement. How much does it matter, do you think, when one person finds themselves in a different place, when there are so many thousands of others who are still part of these extremist movements?
That's a really great question, because I am personally frustrated by one person at a time, and it takes patience. When I get told that, I made a difference in someone's life, I am very satisfied with that, and I know that Christian is as well. I think it makes a difference if that one person will make the ripple. If that one person will make the ripple, and maybe it's to two people, maybe that then those two people are to four people. So I think that each person can make a difference. I think that one person can make a ripple and change the world, and Christian Piccolini is doing that.
What is it that you hope is accomplished very directly, very specifically? What do you think? What do you hope someone walks away from these events with next month?
Right. So I believed that hate was born from someone in your family raising you with hate. And I want people to understand that hate comes in a lot of different ways. And we who are not in hate, who don't feel that way and maybe don't understand it, we need to pay more attention to how people are brought into hate and try to help them not stay in it and help them get out of it.
Something that that Christian Piccolini says in that TED Talk that I jotted down actually is, hatred is born of ignorance, fear is its father, and isolation is its mother. When we don't understand something, we tend to be afraid of it. If we keep ourselves from it, that fear grows, and sometimes it turns into hatred. Something to think about. Mindy, one more time, tell us where people can find out more information about the 7 days events.
Our website is give7days.org. It's giveseven days.org. Our events do start on April 9th on a Tuesday, and they run through Monday, April 15th. And I hope many, many people in the community do come and participate in all the acts of kindness that we've provided and the education.
Well, I think a lot of people are very appreciative of the work you're doing in the community, Mindy, and thankful for the way you've responded to tragedy in your life by making a difference in the community. So thanks for spending a little time with us talking about it this morning.
Brian, thanks so much.
When we come back, when you look up to see the stars, you probably don't think about the fact that there might be one of your fellow humans looking back, but that's just what our guest did. He took the pictures of what he saw that allow him now to share what he experienced with us. We'll hear about it when we come back. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday was the best day of the year, opening day of the 2019 Major League Baseball season. We celebrated it with a live broadcast from Kauffman Stadium. You can hear that fun at kcur.org/up-to-date. Join us on Monday. Steve Kraske will be back. The National Bio and Agro Defense Facility that is slated to be America's most prominent animal disease research lab is, of course, in Manhattan, Kansas, but delays in getting the operation up and running have raised some eyebrows. We'll talk about that Monday on the program. Only a tiny fraction of humanity will ever experience the thrill of traveling through space. But who would have expected that? For that lucky few, one of the most rewarding parts of escaping our atmosphere and rising above our chaos and conflict would be turning around and looking back on the beauty of the planet they'd escaped. Astronaut Terry Virts took more than 319,000 photos, as well as video, during his two trips to space so that we could have a little taste of that experience. And he's in Kansas City to share some of it, and he joins us in our studio this morning. Commander Virts, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's so great to be back in Kansas City. It's awesome.
It's great to have you back. And we should mention that those photos, many of them, will be on display at the Leopold Art Gallery in Brookside starting tonight, right?
Tonight we open it up. It's pretty exciting. My first ever photo exhibit.
Being an artist with an exhibition, a big deal.
It's really cool. It's really a big deal. I'm excited about it.
Well, I want to talk about that transition to becoming an artist, but let's start with where it starts, which is becoming an astronaut, which a lot of kids grow up wanting to do. Is it something you always wanted to do?
I did. The very first book I ever read was about Apollo. I can remember being in kindergarten, and it was one of those cardboard one-line-per-page books.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, wow, these guys went to the moon. That sounds pretty cool. And so I grew up with pictures of airplanes and galaxies and stars, and you know, that was my room. And it was something I just always wanted to do.
And, of course, the path to that, at least one of the paths, was to first become a pilot.
That's right. So, you know, I read a book called The Right Stuff when I was
yes.
in high school.
A lot of us saw that movie when we were kids.
The movie later on. In fact, I watched the movie with my commander the night before my first shuttle launch. It was cool. And then I brought the DVD into space. So
you always dream that that's what happens with astronauts, that they actually watch The Right Stuff movie, but they really do.
I did, personally, yeah. So, and that... I didn't know what to do. My mom and dad didn't go to college. It wasn't like I was born into the family of astronauts or anything. So, but that book, The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, really inspired me and kind of showed me the path. And these guys were all test pilots, and I wanted to fly anyway, so it was a great path to get to where I wanted to go.
You certainly did fly quite a lot, right? You went to the Air Force Academy, and you ended up flying F-16s.
I was an F-16 pilot for about a decade and also a test pilot, so I flew a lot of different airplanes as a test pilot. And then I went to NASA. So I had 11 houses in 11 years in the Air Force. And then I went to NASA, and I was there for 16 years. So it was not a typical Air Force career, but it was pretty fun.
The idea of capturing images as a photographer, was that something you planned ahead of time, or was it something that you thought about on your first trip to space, on the space shuttle?
I'm a photographer. I'm the kind of dad, you know, the kids are like, "Dad, stop taking pictures."
Stop taking pictures of the planet, Dad.
I know. Stop taking pictures of us. But when I was a kid, I got a Konica SLR with the 35mm film. And again, nobody in my family was a photographer at all. So I had to learn about focus and exposure.
A real camera.
All that stuff. Yeah.
Not like taking pictures on your phone.
There were no phones back in the day, right?
Yes.
So that really kind of sparked a lifelong interest in photography. So before I went into space, and every astronaut is a photographer and we get training and we learn how to do it, but not every astronaut is really a photographer in their heart. But a few of us are.
I didn't realize that all astronauts got training in photography.
We have we call it the photo TV group, where there's so many different cameras and video systems, and it's a lot of technical stuff. You just have to set up. It's like a studio in space. But a lot of that is just for work. But for me, it was more my passion. That was the way I shared this experience and adventure with people on Earth.
The mission, when you eventually did end up at the International Space Station, and you were commander of the International Space Station for how long? Was it 7 months?
For that mission was 200 days, and a little over 100 of those days, or roughly, I was commander.
The mission was not just to take photos, right?
Oh, no.
What were you actually there to do?
Taking photos was on my spare time. They never scheduled me time to take pictures.
You were off the clock when you were taking all these photos.
The work day ended usually about 7 o'clock, and that's kind of when I got going. But the job on the space station is everything. I mean, you have to do science experiments. You have to fix things. You're the plumber. You do spacewalks. When cargo ships come up, you have to grab them with a robotic arm. And then you're the accountant, because you have to keep track of all the stuff that goes in. And you're the TV star, because you're doing interviews. And I actually filmed a movie called Beautiful Planet. It's an IMAX film. Yeah. In my spare time, along with several other astronauts worked on it. So you kind of have to do everything. On a shuttle flight, it was very focused. I was a shuttle pilot. On my very first flight, we brought up these two modules and finished building the space station. So you had a specific task. Now on these long-duration space station flights, everybody does everything. I was the dentist, the crew dentist.
I can't imagine that was something you had a lot of training for.
I had training. I went to the University of Texas Dental School and learned how to, you know, remove teeth. But one of my crewmates' fillings came out, so it was the first ever filling in space.
Wow.
So that was kind of cool.
Do we have pictures of that?
I do have pictures of that, but I normally, it's like a medical thing. It's just funny. It's me sticking my hand in my buddy's mouth to put his to put his filling back in.
So dentistry aside, you have all of these qualifications to be a pilot and an astronaut. How did you end up as a professional photographer? How did you make the transition from something, from a dad who likes to take pictures, to really doing this in a professional
It's
quality
part of my
way?
Job. Yeah. So when I left NASA, I had been there for a long time. I had done everything there was, and I just wanted to actively pick my next phase of life rather than just kind of hang around and wonder what's going to happen next. So the first thing I wanted to do was write a book. And ironically, it worked out. National Geographic was actually looking to write a space photography book. So it was perfect timing. So I wrote View from Above with them. And that was kind of my entrance into, I like it as a hobby, but now we need to pick out which photos, and you have to do the right Photoshop, you know, and go through all of that.
Right.
And this is this gallery at the Leopold Gallery that we're doing that's art. It's not, you know, technical photography. And that's been a lot of fun. Putting pictures on canvas is something that's a little bit different than on photo paper. It's more artistic look. So that really has been a transition.
I do want to talk about kind of the art of it, but I'm also curious about the logistics of just how you take high quality photos from space. The International Space Station, I guess, has sort of a unique feature that made this possible.
The cupola.
The windows.
The window, yeah. So the module that I brought up on my first shuttle flight, ironically, is everybody's favorite place. There's seven windows. If you remember the scene in Star Wars where Luke and Darth Vader are fighting and the Empire Strikes Back, basically Darth Vader is in front of the cupola. It looks exactly like
just
that.
Just surrounded by windows
space in the distance, yeah. So that is where most of my pictures were taken. It's just an amazing view of the planet. Some of the photos that I did were just taking one image. I see this. Let's take a picture. Some of them were you put the camera on a bracket and let it run for a few minutes at 2 or 4 frames a second, and then you can take those pictures and stitch them into a video. So for the IMAX movie, we did that because that big professional Nikon D4, or we had a Canon 1D. Those are the cameras that you see the guys at the Super Bowl or at opening day at Kauffman Stadium. You know, we had that kind of camera.
Yeah.
We had 15 of those kind of cameras. It was wonderful. Now I've got my iPhone, but when I was in space, I had all the hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment.
Well, I'm also just thinking about the data generated by taking that many high-resolution photos. Where does that all go?
So I had this system of compact flashcards. So I would take a series of shots, then I would pull it out, put it in my left pocket, and I'd have some empty CF cards in my right pocket and put it in, and then at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock, midnight, I would sit in front of laptops downloading these things, and then the ground has a system where they would bring the data down to Earth. So that workflow of how to deal with it, look, on Earth, it's a pain. If you're trying to catalog pictures of your kids, that's a pain. But in space, luckily, we had some folks on Earth to help us, but it's definitely a big deal.
Getting things up, I guess, do you still call it the cloud when it's actually going down instead of
there's no clouds up there. That's true. An engineer on the ground would bring it down, and then I don't know what happened to it. And then eventually, you know, it exists in a database. But the video, one of the problems is the bandwidth, right? We don't necessarily have 5G up there. It's more like 2 or 3G, you know.
It's a little better than dial-up, but...
It's not fast. So we had this camera. We had a lot of cameras, but one of them is by Red. Red is a... video manufacturer. A lot of the movies that you see in Hollywood are made by Red. Red or Area are some of the big ones. So this Red camera is amazing. It was the first ever ultra high def, but they warned me it's so, you know, the file sizes are too big. After taking all these stills on my last weekend in space, I said, you know what, that's enough stills. So I got the Red camera out and I shot a terabyte of video one weekend, and everybody freaked out. Which is a lot. Yeah. Everybody freaked out on the ground. And I said, you know what, it'll work out. And it took them about a week, and they got all the video down. And then they made this really cool ultra high. It was the first ever ultra high def. You know, this was four years ago. And it was awesome. It just took a little bit of time to get the video down.
Wow. Let's talk about some of the photos that you took specifically, including some that maybe we'll see in the exhibition. I mean, you mentioned that it is different taking scientific shots, the things you had to do for work, from actually making art. What did you learn in this process?
So you can't just put the camera on green auto and hit and shoot. Almost every picture you take has to be manually manipulated because the lighting is so extreme. During the daytime, it's the brightest bright you've ever seen. And on the dark side of the Earth at nighttime, it's the darkest dark, right? So you have to know what ISO setting, you know, how sensitive to make the camera, what kind of shutter speed you're going to use, what kind of aperture you're going to use. So there's a lot of you just have to know, all right, it's daytime, it's ocean, it's super bright, or it's nighttime, it's aurora. So just getting to know those settings was important.
Can we talk about some of the actual photos that will be on display?
Yeah,
I've seen some of them. I was struck by one of them in particular, the one of nighttime on the East Coast. What I gathered was the East Coast of the United States. The lights that are shining and sort of strung out in what look like strings of light, almost like capillaries or veins of some kind.
America's interesting in that city lights are linked by our interstate system. So you can find your way around America at night by the interstates.
It's an interstate map you're looking down at.
I-40, I-95. The East Coast is I-95. So you can really see that. But one of the profound things that hit me, it was my fifth night in space, and I realized it, during the daytime you can't see people. Now, if you know what you're looking at, you can see cities. They're kind of the concrete is gray. Sometimes you can see airplane contrails, but for the most part, you don't see people at day. But at nighttime, it's a very different story. You see city lights. And what this thought that I had, I had never heard anybody say this before, but it really stands out, is that you're not looking at population, but you're looking at wealth. And it was profound to look at our planet and kind of see where wealth was.
Say more about that. Where? How did you see examples of that?
So America and the East Coast, or, you know, through Chicago, is obviously there's a lot of wealth because there's a lot of lights on. And that's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation, but it pretty much is, you know.
Because there were some very high-density population areas that did not light up at night.
So there's several, but Africa is – there's a billion people in Africa. And the Nile in the north is lit up. In the West Coast, there's the oil, you know, Nigeria, there's a lot of oil there. So there's some lights there. Johannesburg, South Africa, it looks like a European city. And in between those three things, there's a billion people and there's no lights. There's none. There's lightning. The storms there are amazing, but yeah.
I also thought that some of your shots that that showed the sun sort of rising,
right.
I gather, or setting, yeah. perhaps, over the
it's hard to tell, yeah.
over the horizon of yeah. Earth were very striking. How do you?
I love those.
Those are hard shots for those of us on Earth, even under more ideal circumstances.
Right. And the really hard thing with that, and I took thousands. I could never get enough sunrise or sunset shots. But the lighting changes so quickly. It's you're going 5 miles a second. So on Earth, it takes the sunset an hour, you know. In space, it's seconds. In fact, I was timing it once. It's about 15 seconds from pitch black to bright. You know, it depends on your orbital mechanics, but it happens fast. So you really have to be taking a lot of shots per second, and you have to kind of quickly tweak the shutter and the aperture to get the exposure reasonable as you're going through this really fast sunrise.
But how many chances do you get it? Do you have to wait 24 hours for your next sunrise?
No. It's every 90 minutes. So you go around the Earth every hour and a half. Although there's this thing called beta. So imagine if you're orbiting directly at the sun. So the sun rises in front of you and it sets behind you.
Okay.
That would be 0 degrees beta. Now imagine if the sun's off your left wing or your right wing. So as you're flying around the Earth, the sun is always off 90 degrees to the left. And we have these periods called high beta. And this happened to me twice where there was a week without a sunset. So you could just kind of look through the window on the left side of the station. And I made some really cool time lapses where the sun just makes a little short circle and it never sets.
Wow.
So I went a week without a sunset and then a week without a sunrise. It's kind of like being in the Arctic in the summertime, you know, the sun never sets.
So I'm struck by 319,000 photos.
Right.
You now are thinking about putting together a photo exhibition like the one we're going to see here in Kansas City.
Right.
How many photos are in the exhibition?
18.
18 photos. And you've got more than that in the book, but still
right.
only
a few hundred.
Yeah. How on Earth or off of Earth do you go about choosing photos?
It was a long process. So when I was in space, if I took a really good one, I put it in a favorites folder. And that's I still kind of use that as my basis for the pictures I have.
There's how many were in your favorites folder by the end of this?
There's a few hundred. I've got it.
Oh, okay.
You know, I've got my Africa, my South America, my sunrises, my life in space. You know, there's different – it's categorized by folders.
Well, that's a manageable number. You showed a lot of restraint in only putting a few hundred.
There may be 1,000. There's a bunch. But so what I did when I wrote this book for Nat Geo, I got a photo editor, thank God. Kate Bolson is her name. So she went through all hundreds of thousands of pictures.
Wow.
She looked at all my pictures.
Heroic.
And so when I put this gallery together, I started off with about 100 and I pared it down. And then I worked with Paul Durrell, who runs the Leopold Gallery. And he's like, hey, I think people will like these. And so we kind of pared it down to this number. And then Kate also helped because she knows all my work. And then she helped with getting the color and lighting and stuff ready for printing. So,
well, and do you have experience with the printing side of photography?
Zero. But, you know, my printing is I put it online at Walgreens and then I go pick up a print. So
like most of the rest of us.
Yeah. So, and this isn't just printing because we're doing it on canvas and then you have to stretch it onto a frame. And that's an art. It's not a science that I don't know about. So they have a great group. Terry over there did the printing, and they did a fabulous job. It really came out good, I think.
We are talking with Terry Virts, who is an astronaut, but also now a professional photographer, whose exhibition, View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World, will be at the Leopold Art Gallery on 63rd Street, opening tonight and then continuing through April 27th. You can find out more at leopoldgallery.com. You know, people who make art aren't always thrilled with questions like this, but I guess I'm wondering, what do you think these photographs sort of have to tell us? Is there an underlying theme or message that, as you've spent all of this time looking at them and going through them, that you think is conveyed by them?
There's a lot of stories here. First of all, the universe is an amazing place. You know, there's a few photographs looking out at the galaxy and seeing all these stars. Second of all, is our planet is so beautiful and diverse. The aurora is amazing.
Looking and there's a photo of the aurora, the green...
The northern lights, yeah, aurora borealis.
Up over the horizon of the Earth.
It is, over UK. That was a pass I did from basically England all the way past Moscow into Siberia. It's an amazing video, but one of the still images from that is printed out. I love seeing sunrises and sunsets on the horizon because you can see really detailed divisions in our atmosphere. You see a line where there's red and orange and blue. You can see thunderstorms that are 1,000 or 1,500 miles away from where I was taking the picture, but you see the really intricate details of the thunder clouds or shadows. There's a giant thunderstorm probably 60,000 feet up, and you see this shadow that's going hundreds of miles across the Earth's surface right at dusk. Those are some really cool pictures. There's one on the Nile River that's amazing. You see this green, lush river through this giant desert. And then there's the delta where there's a big triangle as it goes into the Mediterranean. There's just so many different aspects of the Earth. It's a really diverse and beautiful planet.
We'll have to take your word for this, but how well does the photographic representation of these scenes really capture them? You can do a lot with photography, of course, but
right.
But how closely does it actually bring the experience to us?
So I tried to get the colors to match, and
because you can do post-production work and change that.
You can change all that, yeah. So we tried to get the colors to match my memory, because everybody's memory is different and you perceive it differently.
Yeah.
The camera does not actually capture the sunrises and sunsets are a little bit different in your eye and in the chip, and that the technical aspect of what frequencies and stuff, you actually see different lines. It's a similar kind of thing, but you see it differently. But the most important part is the emotional impact of looking out of a window and seeing your planet and not being on it is a powerful thing, and that's hard to capture in a photo. Having a large print, you know, a 3 or 4 foot wide print helps. Yeah. It kind of makes it, it's better than looking at it on your phone.
Yeah, you might see more in it.
And it impacts. The Bahamas are spectacular. I mean, it's just amazing. But
because of the colors?
Because of the colors, and there's so many details. And I was just standing in front of this picture just looking at it. It's amazing. You see these little lagoons and these little islands. You can see a lot of sand dunes underwater. So, you know, looking through the ocean, are there sand dunes, kind of like Namibia, or there's other sand dunes on Earth, only they're underwater, which is pretty amazing.
There are some other interesting things that I've learned as I was preparing for this interview, some of which are a little surprising. For example, you are one of only three actual astronauts to have appeared in the Star Trek franchises. You had a cameo role on Star Trek Enterprise.
That was so cool. So a colleague of mine, Mike Fink, had been on a 6-month mission, and I was his support guy. So I was like tasked with helping him through his mission. So when he came back and landed, I flew him out to California in a T-38. We were talking to some NASA contractors, thanking them. Hey, thank you for building this equipment and that equipment. And he had gotten to know Scott Bakula, who was captain of Enterprise on the Star Trek series.
Right.
It was the last Star Trek TV series until one just started this past year. So Scott said, well, why don't you come out? So Mike went out to it was the last episode ever, Paramount Studios, and I was with him, and they talked to the producer. Hey, and so they're like, "Oh, go if you can find a suit that fits you, you can get on the show." So we got to go have my few seconds of fame on Star Trek. It was pretty cool.
And I hear something about a reality show.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get that going. We've talked to some production companies, and there's a lot of excitement. I want to make a show where I got to see Earth from space, and I saw these places. So I want to go visit those places that I saw, get to know the people, see how the Earth shapes their lives, you know, because people who live in Kamchatka have volcanoes, and people who live in the Bahamas have ocean, and do maybe an Anthony Bourdain-like show with a space angle.
Hmm. Well, that sounds actually really interesting. I would watch that show.
Hopefully it'll be good, I think.
You also brought with you into the studio today a baseball jersey. What am I looking at?
Absolutely. There? So this is a Brooklyn Dodgers jersey, number 42. I was on Expedition 42, and I'm a big fan. I did this thing called ISS Play Ball, where I took a picture of all the baseball stadiums. So yesterday was the best day of the year. Like, I'm so happy. I was reading, you know, my Astros this morning, or I'm an Orioles fan. I grew up in Baltimore. And then,
we'll forgive you that, but go on.
Hey, you guys, Astros and Kansas City have won the same number of World Series
well.
Recently.
That's true, yeah. Yes.
So anyway, so I have this Dodgers jersey that I flew because Jackie Robinson is one of my heroes. And I'm going to go donate it to the Negro League Baseball Museum here in about an hour. So if you get a chance, come on out at 1 o'clock. I'm going to present it to Bob Kendricks, who runs the museum, and I'm really, really excited about that.
Well, I am sure they are also very excited about having it, and I think a lot of folks will be excited to see your work, which, as we mentioned, is at the Leopold Art Gallery opening tonight. There's a personal appearance by the artist, by Terry Virts, from 6 to 9 p.m. The exhibit runs until April 27th. You can find out more at leopoldgallery.com. Terry Virts, 319,000 photos in space, many in a book, 18 of them on display here in Kansas City for the next month. Thank you so much for spending a little while with us today.
It's great to be here.
It was really a pleasure.
Thanks.
Yesterday, we met some of the people who make opening day and every game day at the K a fun experience. You can hear them at kcur.org/up-to-date, where you'll also find other previous episodes. Don't forget to find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date, and I'm at ptsbrian. You can also like KCUR on Facebook. Join us on Monday when Steve Kraske's back. Common mistakes parents and adults make in addressing attention deficit disorder. Also, how to reach a better diagnosis and treatment. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Chris Pruitt, Erica Hunzinger, Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. It's been a great week with you all. Thanks for letting me host your show. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend. You are up to date.